Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. We'll be speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is May 5th, 2011. I want to thank our listeners, and I know that so many of our listeners have shown that they have been helped through important life decisions. They have found direction and guidance in understanding their rights, freedoms, and their options when dealing with vaccinations in the United States, no matter what state they reside in. In addition to Alan, today we're going to have Greg Glazer, a specialist in constitutional law, with us, which he is usually the first Thursday of each month. And for those who are new to Blog Talk Radio, you will find the chat right below the announcement page on the internet. We welcome your comments and your questions, and only those who have been informed of their have informed us of their identity and the purpose for their call will be able to call in live and get on the air. We often have Dr. Bob Brook, an expert in global warming and environmental technology from North Carolina State University, call in and give us a scientific perspective on the shows and some little background information there. If you enjoy these programs, I welcome you to please share them with your friends by clicking the Twitter, Facebook, and other share buttons right there on the homepage. You may download the archived shows to your computer, your iTunes, iPod, your cell phone, and other mobile device for your convenient listening. Our popularity does keep growing because we talk about current and relevant news topics each week. If you would like to be a sponsor of our show, do contact us by friending the click that says to friend the show and send us a message. So we're going to be getting started in just a moment to introduce our regular co-hosts, Greg Glazer, who is an independent constitutional lawyer in Danville, California, with research published regularly at logicalhierarchy.com, a constitutional law research and analysis of forced vaccination during declaration of martial law, war, outbreak, or pandemic, and this is going to be the topic today. And we also have our regularly scheduled co-host, Alan Phillips, who provides comprehensive, authoritative information about vaccine exemptions that you can trust. He is a leading vaccine rights attorney with years of experience helping clients legally avoid vaccines in a wide variety of vaccine refusal settings, and is now an author with Natural News. So it is critical for parents, students, immigrants, healthcare employees, military personnel and contractors, and also other agencies, attorneys and clients, virtually anyone who is concerned with legally avoiding vaccines in the United States, to listen to our shows and know that there are people who are expert in this field that you can contact for assistance. We also have, so we're just going to go ahead and they are both on the line and just welcome them today. And I will also check the chat and see if anybody's listening. Okay, I see a couple of people in the chat room today. Hi, Bob and Neil. Welcome, folks, Greg and Alan.
Well, pleasure to be here as always, Debbie, and always a special pleasure, Greg, to have you join us first Thursday of the month. Greg brings wonderful depth and dimension of expertise to my own vaccine rights work that really helps fill out, deepen, and explain some of the boundaries and situations there. So good morning, Greg.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on the show today. Really happy to talk about constitutional issues.
Sure, and we're going to pick up where we left off last month, but I thought if the two of you would indulge me for just a minute here, I had an interesting situation come to my attention just not more than 10, 15 minutes ago at the most. And Greg, it's right up our alley. I wanted to run it past you for your attention, so I'll apologize for springing this on you with very short notice, but I think it's one that you'll have a quick and simple, hopefully, answer to. If that's ever possible in law. And so with your permission, I'll go ahead and share this with you, because this is something this is something that falls within the larger arena of I think we are seeing and will see more and more creative efforts, if that's a proper phrase here, on the part of pro-vaccine advocates to basically counteract the growing movement of parents and citizens concerned about vaccines and the growing overall exemption rate that we see. This is understandably causing public health officials with a mainstream view on vaccines a lot of concern. And hopefully all of this will fuel more genuine, open, and objective discussions about the larger vaccine controversy. But here it is in a nutshell. And honestly, the most alarming part of this is that it's happening right here in my very own school district, and somebody on a vaccine group from who knows what other part of the country brought this to my attention. So I was grateful to hear that. So here it is in a nutshell. The superintendent of my school district here in Orange County, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is initiating a vaccine contest for adolescents in the public schools. And I haven't even read the details of this. I didn't have time. But what I got from this, it looks like they're offering every child who gets at least one of the three recommended vaccines, or more than one recommended one that they listed there, it appears they get to be entered in a contest to win an iPod.
Oh, my God.
So, now, Greg, you know, I think, that I'm not in any sort of comprehensive sense whatsoever a constitutional law attorney, and yet, within the narrow focus of vaccines and vaccine rights, I have explored and researched over and over again, vaccine issues where repeatedly and recurringly bring me in touch with the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause, both which pertain to religious rights and limits on what government can do, imposing on religion, and then the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause and Due Process Clause. Those are constitutional provisions that I see coming up over and over again. So I wanted to just throw out here my first quick constitutional assessment of this idea of a public school vaccine contest, and get your feedback on this as well. My first thought is that any parent whose child is not vaccinated because of a religious objection is a child who, by definition, can't participate in this contest, and therefore this contest is discriminatory. It discriminates against those children whose parents have religious objections. I see that as an imposition on the free exercise of religion, and I also see it as, though certainly I'm sure unwittingly and unintentionally on the part of the school district, nonetheless, I see that as an establishment clause issue, because what they really are doing there, however unwittingly or unintentionally, is supporting, in effect, or furthering those children whose parents are members of religions that don't object to vaccines, as against those whose children are children of parents who do have religious objections. And then that also then similarly raises for me a question under the Equal Protection Clause, because laws, state laws have to be applied, state and local laws, government have to apply laws equally. And this seems to be a contest that necessarily excludes, again, those with whose parents have objections to vaccines on religious grounds. So with that as kind of my first off-the-cuff assessment, please enlighten me and our listeners today, Greg, with any further difference of his opinion or cooperation or additional comments you might have on that.
Sure, yeah. I would be inclined to actually disagree that this would be a violation of the First Amendment. Here we have a public school which is allowed to set its own rules because there's no requirement that a person go to public school. You can go to private school if you wish, and then or do homeschooling. And then as for the whether this is discriminatory as in regards to one particular religion, it doesn't seem to be a law that is directed to exclude a particular religious philosophy. Because many religions would oppose vaccines, many religions would support vaccines, so it doesn't seem to be particularly religiously related. And then as for whether or not this is a providing a benefit to one particular group to the exclusion of another, like as an equal protection clause violation, I would argue that it is it's not a violation because it's such a small and simple benefit. It's like if somebody for religious or cultural reasons decides not to join the marching band, and the marching band has a contest only for its members, the person wouldn't be able to stop the marching band contest on that basis because the law was not directed to prevent that one religious group's exercise of their rights.
Can I make a contribution to this conversation, too?
Certainly.
I'm thinking that it is a bribe, and the approach, and I've seen this in a large scale in England, in the UK, for taking vaccinations also for girls to get the Gardasil. And I am just curious if there is an approach, a legal approach that can be taken, whereas this is not, you know, it's kind of advertising to minors about something that the parents should be in charge of their health care and what philosophy they take. So
we don't know at this point if they're trying to exclude parents, but it certainly is ultimately a parental decision. But I take exception to your first comment about that one has a choice whether or not to go to public school insofar as here in North Carolina, and I would imagine this is the case in most other states, but certainly here in North Carolina, we have a state constitutional right to a public school. In fact, we're required to go to public school unless we choose one of the other options. And so one is not, as a starting place, doesn't really have that choice. I mean, they do have a choice ultimately, but it's not a situation where you just sort of freely pick and choose from the choices and some will pick one and some will pick another. You know, you are in public school unless you opt out and take very specific, you know, measures to do that. And there's no constitutional right to a, at least at a state level, to a non-public school choice. You know, if you have the funds for that or the means available to provide that yourself in homeschool, you have that option. But there's a state constitutional right to the public education. But I'm glad to have an opposing view there. And it was quite a surprise, Greg. But I'm not persuaded. Okay. I don't think you have to have discrimination against a specific religion, an individual religion, to have a violation there, either under establishment or equal protection clauses. But it's an interesting point and maybe one worthy of some further research on my part.
Can I pop in here again? I'm going to pop in. I have tweeted this information out there on the internet, and I got a response that this sounds good, that there's a parent out there who says this might actually get parents moving to protect their children. So we have people on both sides of the issue, people who do want to have their children vaccinated and people who are more concerned about the effects of vaccination.
I think Greg was making a, and correct me if I misunderstand, Greg, because I just want to make sure I do. I think you were making a de minimis argument there that because this is such a small prize in the grand scheme of things, it's really not a substantive violation. But we have Supreme Court precedent that says the loss of First Amendment rights for any amount of time amounts to, and I'm paraphrasing or something exact language, it amounts to substantial harm. If I was correct on that, and if not, of course, please correct me, but the size of the prize, I think, is actually irrelevant in the legal analysis when you're talking about First Amendment rights.
Well, it's not so much the size of the prize as the character of it. So, in this sense, we don't have a particular government benefit that is protecting a right that an individual has. Like, the iPod that one receives doesn't, whether you receive it or don't receive it, doesn't affect any fundamental right or participatory function in government. So it does. So it wouldn't come within the clause. Like it's not like a like a driver's license or something more.
I don't think the Constitution splits those kind of hairs, but I'd be certainly be willing to look at any cases that contradict that assumption. I think the fact here is that the school is selectively and the selectivity is, they're not doing this on purpose, I'm sure, but the selectivity is effectively based on religious beliefs. They are selecting which people can participate in a school, in a government contest, and which ones can't. And I just don't think government has the authority to do that. If it were a private school, I think they could probably get away with it.
There would be some religions that would also not want their participants to, participate in like dance, for example, because of the outfits that they have to wear, And so, would we prohibit the dance classes and any benefits they have? Like, let's say it's an ice cream social or something like that. That's like the equivalent of an iPod. And so,
well, that's somebody choosing to opt out of the dance because of religious belief. That's different than somebody who wants to opt into the contest but can't because they have their religious beliefs won't let them. So I think those circumstances are distinguishable. Well, I don't want to take too much time away from your contest today.
I think this is fascinating, though. This is really fascinating, and maybe it is part of what Greg is. His topic is for today, the forced vaccination. It seems to be intermingled with it. And did you already discuss whether it matters what the prize is? Would it make a difference?
Well, I think that's what he was saying, but, I don't know. Greg, do you want to clarify that?
A government benefit is being provided or withheld, and whether it affects a right, an iPod is not,
but I think it also amounts to endorsement, this government endorsing one of two or more legal options. And that's what's something that any government endorsement of vaccination does. But this just does so in a more sort of unique and deliberate way, I suppose. And that's the reason why I feel like governments should always be required to refer to exemptions whenever they refer to the mandates, which as far as I know, only one state has a law that requires the government to do that. So most states, they send notices home from school at the beginning of every year. You have 30 days or whatever it is in each state to get your kids vaccinated or they're going to be kicked out of school. And they never say, unless you have an exemption. But something like that, and this contest as well.
Another thing to add to this is that the right to bodily integrity, that fundamental right over our bodies that we enjoy the exercise of, is a two-way street. You have the right to say that you don't want the vaccination, but you also have the right to take the vaccination. And so, respecting that right would allow a student, if they choose, to receive the vaccination, and if the principal wants to, have an iPod prize for that, I'd say I'd put it on par with a public health program for something like sit-ups or physical fitness. It's whether it, it's good or bad in the particular instance, it's just a policy decision, and the question is whether or not it's going to be like irrational would be one test, and then as you mentioned, the equal protection clause. If something triggered the equal protection clause in this instance, then I'd say that we'd go through the full scale analysis. But an iPod for a small contest isn't going to be the substantial triggering clause. Is it going
to
trigger?
It just seems that they're trying to manipulate the children. By putting this little grapes in front of them and saying that they can win this thing which they really desire. And
well,
that
in and of itself is not an issue. I mean, they can give prizes to kids. They can reward children for doing well academically. They can reward children for doing things to take care of their health. I mean, I don't see a problem with that. The question is, does any particular act of manipulation raise concerns constitutionally or otherwise in law? And I don't see a problem with the concept of encouraging children to do what they think is the right thing that's productive for them academically or otherwise. But, again, the question is there some law that particular act may breach or bring into question? I'm going to contact the school district superintendent after the show, and I'm going to raise the constitutional issues and ask them to cancel the contest, and we'll see what they do with it. It'll be interesting. I expect they would turn it over to their attorney to do an analysis and see if they come back with an opposing point of view here. But it may be one of those kinds of things where there simply are different legal opinions, and you never really know unless there's a judge that rules on it, and even then, not if somebody appeals the decision. And I don't see this as an issue that ends up in court, but it will be interesting to see what the school's response is to it as well.
Right. It's going to be interesting to see how other school counties, when they hear about this, I call it a ploy. I call it a bribery to manipulate children, just like advertisements and commercials that try and get them to eat sugary sweets. And the fact that it's going through the school system concerns me greatly. I mean, if it was, let's put in an exercise program for the kids and get them outdoors into the sunshine to get their vitamin D, I would be all for it. But if it's to do something to their body, I'm not for that. So anyway,
the question then becomes, when manipulation in and of itself is not a bad thing. That's how you teach. One way or another, you manipulate children into doing something that is ultimately for their good, their own good, academically or otherwise, phys ed, whatever it might be. The question is, who gets to decide what is or isn't good for the children, and when the school steps over a boundary or not? And, of course, the answer to that is, well, we have laws that protect us. And again, the question is, does this step over a boundary or not? And I'm delighted to have Greg's feedback, because he's going to cause me to look a little more closely at my initial reaction here and see whether or not I think I really do have some constitutional ground to stand on. But there's sort of fundamental...
I would say that the first place to look would be Wisconsin versus Yoder, 1972 Supreme Court case that discussed the requirement for Amish teens to go to 9th and 10th grade as a compelling government function. So, if a student has to go to school, has to go to public school, that would be a place that you would start in your analysis. And then whether they had to participate in the contest is the second part. Liberty being a two-way street, if you want to respect bodily integrity, then you have to allow them to have this contest. I also agree with Debbie that this is a terrible policy decision, but that doesn't mean that it is a unlawful decision for administrators to make within their discretion, so long as they are not denying or providing a government benefit or right based on a protected criteria. And in this instance,
well, I believe they clearly are. They're necessarily excluding any child whose parents have religious objections. So to me, that's pretty on its face. It's a religious discrimination.
What if the parents then decided to have a contest for another iPod so that the kids would take vitamin D instead of a vaccination? I'm just throwing that out.
Yeah, I think that would be a nice policy decision.
Okay, so we have to kind of counter it in a balanced way so that everyone's voice is heard rather than just getting one side of the issue.
Yeah, and if we let religions, the specific practices of religions dictate our policy decisions, then that really frustrates the First Amendment. That really frustrates government. If any one religion can object to a particular government function on the basis that it, you know, oh, well, we don't like this, or you know, this supports us, you need to respect this, you'd quickly run into so many obstacles that it would be difficult to conduct government, which is why we have this substantial test, that it has to be a substantial interference before you can even trigger the test, before you can even trigger the Equal Protection Clause. And that was the point that I was making. And here in iPod, for this, you know, physical fitness type of test, is not going to qualify.
Well, that certainly makes sense, Chris.
I mean, they didn't pass this rule to direct it against, you know, Christians or Muslims or...
No.
So...
It didn't sound...
Well,
that doesn't sound
religious. That piece doesn't persuade me, because the First Amendment doesn't require a specific religion by name or organized religion to be involved in order for there to be a question about rights under the First Amendment. I mean, we have the line of legal precedent that says, for example, you qualify for a vaccine religious exemption regardless of whether or not you belong to an organized religion. All you have to do is have beliefs that are sincere, that are religious in nature and sincerely held. So I don't think, so I do think there's ground to say that as at least a step in a larger legal analysis, that the fact that it raises a question about those who object to vaccines on religious grounds, whatever their religion is, or even who belong to no organized religion, that part of the analysis, as far as it goes, is a legitimate step. Whether for purposes of having a legitimate objection on constitutional grounds, a more complete analysis favors the objection is a different question, and you raise a really good point, Greg, and with clear explanation for the sort of policy explanation behind the law there, that if everybody could object to anything anytime it had a friction with their religious beliefs, then government would never be able to do anything.
People would use that. Citations for that, I mean, for follow-up research. I mean, we have Church of Leukemia, 1993 U.S. Supreme Court case says, our case has established a general proposition that a law that is neutral and of general application need not be justified by a compelling government interest if it has only the incidental effect of burdening a particular religious practice. It's the same thing in that famous case, Employment Department versus Smith, of about the same era in the 80s. Accommodation for religious practices is incompatible with general requirements must ordinarily be found in the political process. And, you know, you've run the same thing, Bowen versus Roy, 1986 U.S. Supreme Court case. This is where someone was saying that a Social Security number would rob their child of their soul. And the court said that's baloney. We're not going to slow down the administration of government just so, because, I mean, sure, it's going to, the Social Security number will impact, you know, your particular religious belief, but it's not, this rule of government administration, this discretionary decision, is not directed specifically to that religion, so it's not going to trigger the free exercise clause, and that's what the court has.
Okay, so let's segue into your statement on forced vaccination and whether it is or is not lawful.
Sure. Yeah. So forced vaccination is not lawful. In this land, we live in a republic. You have the right to be peacefully natural. Natural means that you are free of a needle in your arm. And so, if the government can, for any reason, forcefully vaccinate you, then they have an absolute power over your human body, and that is against United States law, international law. It's against natural law. No one person, no king, no ruler, no government can exercise absolute power over a fundamental right. Now, there is a situation, there are three situations that I've identified where the government may exercise legitimate power to forcefully vaccinate. And those, but in each of these three situations, the person is not being peacefully natural. And so in the first instance, the first way that the government can forcefully vaccinate a person is if the government has the right of self-defense, or if any other person would have the right of self-defense. So let's say you have an infected individual and they have approached another person with a communicable disease. In that case, they can be quarantined or they can be set aside. because the right of self-defense is on par with bodily integrity. They're both fundamental, inherent rights. And then the second way that the government can forcefully vaccinate is as a legitimate prisoner. So because the government is the caretaker of prisoners, the guardian of prisoners, it can make reasonable decisions for their well-being and health care, and so the government has the discretion to, if it chooses, vaccinate them. But the person can't be a prisoner for the sole purpose of just refusing the vaccination, because that would be self-fulfilling, obviously, and a form of absolute power. And then the third situation is if a person voluntarily enters government property, then they can be subjected to reasonable government regulation. So the definition of what constitutes government property, interestingly, does not include like federal forest lands. There's an inherent and then later recognized right to privacy when you enter public wildlands. So, but if you're entering the town square, a courthouse, for example, then that would be a situation where you could be subject to reasonable regulations issued by the government. So those are the three instances where the government in a republic like the United States can forcefully vaccinate in the event that, for example, like martial law or war outbreak or pandemic. We have some history where the government has tried to forcefully vaccinate in the 1800s in a town called Muncie, Indiana. They issued, there was an outbreak of smallpox, and so, which is a viral disease, and the local government issued an order of quarantine and forceful vaccination, and the people just revolted. They shot government officials, and it just turned out to be this big spectacle, and the bans were lifted, but that's our precedent as to what happens when they try to forcefully vaccinate. And then later on, again with smallpox, we had this case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which we talked about last month, where a preacher resisted a local law saying that he had to vaccinate himself and his family or pay a $5 fine. And so he challenged the law, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court issued this very lofty decision, which has never been revisited. So the oldest case that we have is from the most recent case we have on forced vaccination is from 1905, this Jacobson case, and it says that it has somewhat of a mixed holding. It says that the police power allows the government the right to issue rules requiring vaccination, but it noted that the rule in this instance requiring vaccination was only for a fine. It wasn't a forced needle. The preacher had the right to just leave the jurisdiction if he chose. So that's the status of the law, and different agencies of the government, including the military, have interpreted this particular rule in different ways. And the medical military establishment would certainly like the rule to be interpreted that they are allowed to forcibly vaccinate in the event of declared martial law, war outbreak, or pandemic. By contrast, naturopathic practitioners, many within the liberty movement, would like to interpret Jacobson to limit the power of the government. And both can cite particular provisions of law within the Jacobson opinion that support their provision. So it's that support their position. So it's an unsettled area of law, unfortunately.
Well,
it's an important one.
Boy, there was I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh no. I was just finishing. Go ahead.
Well, there's as there always is with this meaty topic, and this part of it you've taken on so in depth and well with your memorandum. Which, by the way, folks, Greg has written I can't find the words for it, but it's just a terrific job on a memorandum looking at the constitutionality of forced vaccination, and his memorandum is available at pandemicresponseproject.com, linked right there on the homepage, pandemicresponseproject.com. Folks interested in this, I encourage you to look at it. He spent a tremendous amount of time doing great in-depth research on this, and it's just very, very well analyzed and researched, and we're delighted to have that work and to share it with you through the Pandemic Response Project. I got several follow-up points here. Jacobson, somewhat disturbingly, at least from my, shall I say, biased point of view on the vaccine controversy, has been endorsed in subsequent court cases, in fact, even extended. The original holding, I think, arguably concerns only an outbreak or emergency context, and yet it has been held to apply to outside of that context. And just as recently as a Fourth Circuit case about 6 weeks ago, ruling came down with the Fourth Circuit in a vaccine case, where they once again pointed out that the case had previously been endorsed and applied to non-emergency situations, and they were doing the same thing again, which is sort of frustrating because the attorney who lost in this recent Fourth Circuit case was making the argument, and reasonably so based on reading just Jacobson itself and not looking what subsequent cases may have done with Jacobson, that this vaccine mandate authority really only applies to an emergency situation. And yet I think Jacobson is probably the basis for vaccine mandates ever since, at least part of the primary legal justification. But there was something you were saying, and I think you were saying as sort of a concept or starting point with regard to government limitations on government authority. But so I just wanted to ask your clarification on another point here, that as I think you know, Greg, the emergency health laws around the country and probably most states allow state government authorities, if the state or perhaps even a local county declares an emergency, an infectious disease emergency, they can then mandate vaccines without exemptions. And I've seen... In some cases, I've seen laws that even throw medical exemptions out the window, and that to me seems to be contrary to Jacobson. But the point I wanted to, I'm sort of winding my way around trying to get to, is that it appears to me in a lot of these laws that they, governments also are giving themselves authority to quarantine people who refuse, and in many cases they are giving themselves authority to decide a lot of the quarantine parameters, in particular where they get quarantined. So I think a lot of people have a very legitimate concern that if there's another fake pandemic, for example, that governments may declare an emergency and people who refuse the vaccines might be thrown in a government facility. Does that seem inconsistent, or when might that kind of authority be inconsistent with the principles you were just talking about of government limitations of that kind of authority?
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the essence of the question being presented, and that's the essence of the debate here. According to Jacobson, I will quote directly from the United States Supreme Court opinion, there is, of course, a sphere within which the individual may assert the supremacy of his own will and rightfully dispute the authority of any human government, especially of any free government, existing under a written constitution to interfere with the exercise of that will. Now, Jacobson recognized the right of bodily integrity, as have subsequent court cases, for example, Cruzan, which would be a classic case. Now, Jacobson also recognized the police power. So we have these dueling interests. One is the right of the individual to the integrity of his own body. He can't force a needle on him. On the other hand, we have this right of the police power, which is the duty of the public health authorities, the duty of the executive branch to protect people from disorder, disease, poverty, and crime, according to the United States Supreme Court. And so, disease. So how do you protect against disease but also respect bodily integrity? So it's this, there's this tension, and it's very very undecided, and it may ultimately end up being decided not even by United States courts. It may ultimately end up going to the World Health Organization, which has the power to declare what's called a pandemic, which has a legal definition, and a pandemic has to be a disease that caused by disease-causing agents that infect humans, and it must be spread easily and sustainably among humans. And once they declare a pandemic, then they can issue orders and for public health measures. And one of those orders that has been stated that they can do is forced medical procedures, including forced vaccination. And in reading the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, passed in 1948, summer 10, 1948, there's only one phrase that could possibly protect people that would respect bodily integrity, and you're not going to like it. It's Article 3. Here we go. Here's the quote. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Close quote. Now, when I say the word security, what does that bring up in your mind?
Well, it could go either way. That could be protection of personal autonomy or protection of harm from other people who pose a risk to you. You know, I could see that as favoring or countering the individual right, for example, to refuse vaccines. I do want to mention a point here, because this is something that came up a lot during the pandemic as it first was declared and began to play out over a period of months. There were an awful lot of people who were shouting and spreading fears of World Health Organization taking over the world in one sense or form or degree or another. My read of the international health regulations is, while the language is very strong, is that ultimately it's language of suggestion and not language of mandate. I don't believe the World Health Organization has authority to mandate the internal affairs of nations, although it certainly has authority for all the subscribing nations, which is most of them, over international concerns. And the CDC gave a real interesting example as a quick side note on the overlap of jurisdictional powers, and they gave a hypothetical instance involving an international airport where an infectious disease incident there could involve local, state, national, and World Health Organization authorities. But I don't believe the World Health Organization, in declaring a pandemic, that in and of itself would give it authority, for example, to mandate that everybody in the U.S. has to be vaccinated.
I'll give you the quote. Okay. This is the World Health Organization Constitution, adopted in 1946. Article 21, quote, Health Assembly shall have authority to adopt regulations concerning sanitary and quarantine requirements and other procedures designed to prevent the international spread of disease. So they have the right to declare a pandemic based on their definition, and they have the right to sanitary and quarantine requirements designed to prevent the international spread of disease. So that
right,
sounds to me
key
like...
Word there is, the key word there is international. So if there's, you know, so they can and do control who has to get what vaccines to travel from Spain to Ecuador or, you know, between countries. But that's not an authority to reach into individual countries. That concerns the international spread, risk and threat international spread, which is why, for example, the international airport hypothetical is one where they theoretically could reach in. You know, if we have an international airport in Kansas, you know, out in the very heart of a very large, geographically large nation, but if there being an international airport, it has international implications, and that's why the World Health Organization, the WHO, could argue that they have authority to be involved in that situation. But an outbreak in Austin, Texas, unless it had a risk of spread to Mexico, for example, as an international, making an international incident, I don't think the WHO could come in. Unless invited now, because this is another thing, and I don't think all these lines are by any means crystal clear, because my impression is, while there may be some fairly clear lines as a starting point, I think my understanding is that any of these different levels, from local right on up to international, any one of these levels can invite the participation of any other level, any one of these jurisdictions, if you will, if they choose to do so. So, and something that might inherently not involve the WHO could still involve the WHO if they were invited to be involved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they set up these conferences where they go and participate and then bring laws into conformity with the World Health Organization regulations. I mean, that's like Codex Alimentarius, you know, for example. I'm not sure how familiar listeners are with Codex, but that's an interesting reading. It's where the international bodies, these tribunals, you know, people who you've never heard of, you wouldn't even recognize their faces if you saw them on TV, set rules for food and drug and many issues relating to just societal order. And then the nation, after these rules are set, nations have to then go to their legislatures and bring their laws into conformity. And, you know, sometimes it takes a lot of time to get it done. And but, yeah, it's called harmonization, codex
harmonization. But let me clarify, if I may ask you for clarification. You say that you phrased it like this, and I wasn't sure if it was casual language or you meant literally the wording that you used. You said they have to go to their state, I mean, their individual national legislatures to bring them into conformity with this. Is this something the countries have to do or something the countries have the choice about whether or not to do?
It's something that they must do as a condition of their participation. Basically, when they sign up with the United Nations, when they sign on to the charter, they agree to respect the regulations of the UN. And so it's a political balance between what is going to infringe upon national sovereignty and what's not. The United States Constitution is vague on the issue. It says that the law of the land is the Constitution and treaties. It doesn't say which trumps which. So
right.
What we have, United Nations is, and Debbie, I'm sure you'll want to chime in on this as well, the United Nations is an oligarchy. You know, it is a government, somewhat of a republic in the sense that it recognizes fundamental rights, but it is a government comprised or ruled by the select few. Now, oligarchy was a term coined by Aristotle, but it has, you know, subsequently taken on a rule, a meaning different from plutocracy, which is rule by the wealthy. Now, it's just rule by a select few, whether it's and partly the wealthy, partly just the powerful, certain bloodlines are in there, and it's not democratic, but it's presented as such. And the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights is the basis on which it claims legitimacy as some form of republican government. But again, when we look specifically at the wording in that Declaration of Human Rights, the right to bodily integrity is not listed. Now, it is listed in the United States Supreme Court opinions very clearly, right to bodily integrity, stated over and over again. But in the UN regulations, it's just security of person, which is different. And when I hear the word security, it makes me think of government powers bringing, you know, kind of like it makes me think of compromise. Like I think homeland security, I think of regulation. To me, that's security. Bodily integrity is something different.
So you've put forth quite a few new concepts for us to mull around in our minds and understand what the other people are thinking these things mean, and there must be a considerable amount of commentary upon those particular statements that you could probably elucidate more for us. So this oligarchy form of government and power structure, you're saying that all nations who are part of the United Nations are bound to their laws in some way?
Yes, via the United States Constitution, which requires that treaties be placed on par or equal to the United States Constitution. So when the United States agrees to the United Nations Charter or, you know, the Geneva Convention or we sign up to be part of the WHO, then that has the effect of a treaty. And the treaty is that we will abide by these particular rules. Now, sometimes they won't do it. Sometimes they won't abide by the rules if it is seen to be in if the legislature can't be persuaded to pass a particular law, then you have a conflict. And so, but what I think happens realistically is that there are these international meetings which are not public, and which are not democratic. And that's things like the Bilderberg meetings, you know, where individuals get together and very high-powered individuals get together and they figure out, okay, now how are we going to present this to the public? You know, so the media, the mainstream media is involved in presenting it to the public and so forth. And so that's how they will slowly bring the food and drug laws passed internationally into the United States. Through these mechanisms, it's not like our traditional government. I mean, and maybe that's the challenge to sort of conceptualize. I mean, we have this idea of this checks and balances American government, where you have the legislature passes the laws, and then the executive has to approve it, and then the judiciary can examine it in court if you have any disputes on it. Internationally, it's different. It's untested. I mean, I can just quote in particular from. This is a law review article written in 2008 by a prominent scholar saying that the right of coercive international intervention in response to an infectious outbreak remains uncertain and untested under international law, and if invoked, should be limited to extraordinary circumstances. So what I'm finding in my research is that the scholars who are very invested and study this on a regular basis are telling us that these are unsettled questions as to what the power of the United Nations is over forced vaccination basically forced medical procedures and quarantine in the event of infectious outbreak. And so examining...
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please, with your point there. I think finishing up, I think I was interrupting you. Let me see if I can clarify my question.
Yeah, sure. So based on that uncertainty, we are left with two avenues under which we analyze how this will play out, because eventually there's going to be some triggering event where there's history repeats itself. There's going to be some triggering event, and where we get to look to the words of the particular law in question. So we've already talked a little bit about pandemic, a little bit about the right to bodily integrity versus security of the person. And then secondly, we just look at the exigencies of politics and media. How will this play out on a practical level? And depending on your worldview, whether you recognize the pervasive military-industrial complex and New World Order, or are more likely to be listen to the viewpoints of the mainstream media, I think that most people would fall into the latter category of just kind of accepting what they're told and maybe having a few divergent opinions on specialty issues. But most people would just kind of go along with the fear-based reaction solution type of analysis and just say, oh, well, here we have an outbreak. Let's take care of the solution with modern medicine.
Well, let me ask a question, if I may, here, then, because I think to sort of simplify in one sense, you're saying there's some gray areas here, and a lot of times that is what happens in law. Until you have an actual incident that you can bring before a court to get some sort of ruling, and then we get some clarification. But if I'm hearing you correctly, the question of or at least the question it raises for me, then what is exactly the extent of the obligation of countries who sign on to the World Health Organization, and what is the extent of the reach of the World Health Organization? And I think what you're saying is we may not be entirely clear about that. And is it the same question to ask what is a country's ability to refuse or object to? Because I think there are at least a couple of countries whose signing on to the World Health Organization was done in a qualified way. The international health regulations refer to that, and I don't recall the specific countries or qualifications, but they were in essence saying, we agree, accept, or with this qualification, that or the other. And do countries ultimately have autonomy in this arena or not by signing on with the World Health Organization? And not literally every country, but virtually every country has signed on to World Health Organization. So it does seem to be a delicate area. My read of the international health regulations, again, while it was very strong, seemed ultimately be suggestion rather than mandate. And so I'm wondering to what extent, either generally or perhaps with regard to any specific instance, which may at this point be hypothetical in regard to the future, but the World Health Organization might have the intention or desire to go beyond strong suggestion to a level of mandate. With what went on during the pandemic and even the some mainstream authorities, British Medical Journal in particular comes to mind, criticizing World Health Organization authorities and even to the point of suggesting that some of them should resign because of the conflicts of interest and misinformation given out about the pandemic. So, you know, there is certainly, I think, an important first step, more of a technical, legal, analytical assessment. You know, what are the boundaries or what to what extent are they unclear? But then there's a second level here, perhaps among many. What are the potential uses or abuses of the authority that is there? To what extent are they influenced inappropriately by industry, for example, which appeared very much to be something that, that went on during the swine flu pandemic?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And when a government is overly influenced by industry, then it's called a plutocracy. And I think that's part of the oligarchy as well. You know, it's a beast. It's a hybrid, multi-headed beast, and the beast has warring heads that seem to bite each other at times. So, you know, for the individuals who are on the ground just trying to you know, live naturally, that you're basically just trying not to be squashed. In Article 30 of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, it says that nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, group, or person any right to engage in any activity or to perform any act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein. Then they also talk about how everyone has duties to the community. So now this is a little bit different than a republic in the United States. I mean, it's kind of maybe parsing words here, but the United Nations is built upon a more democratic and state-oriented or government-oriented foundation than the United States, which is built much more on liberty, or at least in theory. And so I think that if these questions of what are the rights and responsibilities of individuals and then, in particular, what is the right to bodily integrity? If that question is decided by United Nations tribunals, then it will be resolved in favor of the state. Whereas it's more likely to be, it will be resolved in favor of the United Nations government programs, like the World Health Organization. By comparison, in the United States, there may even be a chance that a court would rule in favor of the individual, but I think that we won't really get to answer that question. I mean, if it hasn't been ruled upon yet since Jacobson, then, I mean, are we running out of time for there to be a ruling on it? I mean, gosh, it would take 4 years. Is there likely to be a major event in the next 4 years which would transfer more power over to the UN? I mean, this organization was founded in 1948 in Rome, and since then, has it been gaining more or less power? Well, invariably, the answer is more, especially through trade organizations. And so it seems to be escalating. You see, like, it's almost like a beast coming out of the sea. Its head is rearing. We're seeing more of its power. One quote from James Warburg is that we will have world government. The only question is whether it will be by consent or by force.
Okay. Well,
that's a terrible thought.
I am really listening to this conversation, and we have no time left today, so we're going to have to continue on with it. Next session, that's going to be June, and the first week in June, I want to talk about this codex, the United Nations, an allegory, are we really free, who's in charge of our body, on and on. We're going to sign off, and I want to thank you so much. Very, very fascinating discussion today.
Oh, terrific input, as always, Greg. Very much appreciated.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Think of us together. Let your truth be a girl. One.